Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and here's a phrase you don't hear on your typical finance show.
Watch for those cow patties.
That's our own Chris Farrow with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Chris says if you're looking for an indication of whether the economy will slide into recession, here's some advice.
Watch for those cow patties.
So what, pray tell, does Mr. Farrow mean by cow patties? Is he talking about A, hamburger sales? As McDonald's stock goes, some say, so goes the economy. Or are cow patties B, the bad news coming from banks recently? Chris says the more of it that's disclosed, the better off the economy could be. Or is it C, actual cow patties? They can be used for biofuel, which could ease fears of rising energy costs. No clue? Sit tight. The answers on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, this is Marketplace Money. The dollar's falling, the subprime market's in meltdown, banks say they're losing billions, but we consumers are still spending. GDP is still gaining. What say you, recession or no? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
So, have you heard it recently? The R word seems to be cropping up a lot. Folks worrying about the specter of recession. The concerns have picked up steam since the credit crisis busted out in August. Many experts say we're not quite there yet, but even Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke told Congress that the risks of recession are growing. So with all these varying predictions, we thought it would be good to find out what you can do to prepare for the possibility of recession. Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Jill Barchet has some answers.
If you live on the Florida coast during hurricane season, you probably have some bottled water and plywood window boards around, just in case. Wall Street investors are doing something similar with their portfolios, getting them ready in case the storm comes.
I think you have to mentally as well as financially prepare your portfolio for a recession.
That's David Darst. He's the chief investment strategist at Morgan Stanley. He says there's a 40% chance the economy will fall into a recession. That means there's a 60% chance there won't be a recession. Even so, Morgan Stanley has been telling clients to sell some of their stocks. After all, history shows that stocks tend to fall 8% way ahead of a recession, 6 to 12 months before the storm strikes.
There's no reason to stay there on the edge of the beach and try to guess that the storm's going to pass you by or not be that severe. If the weather reports are building, no reason why you can't pull back a little bit. And so we think this is a prudent time to lighten up in some of the areas where there have been big gains.
Just a bit of stock selling, less than 10% of your portfolio, and not a fire sale, a little bit, slowly, each month. Dar says to stockpile the proceeds in a cash account or very liquid assets like money markets, treasuries, or short-term one-year notes.
When the stocks drop, you can then deploy that cash and buy these stocks at lower prices.
There's other fine-tuning you can do. Lakshman Achathan is the managing director of Economic Cycle Research Institute. He says you can shift away from the United States to other countries where the economy is going strong. And you can move away from industries like automobiles and appliances, things that consumers don't buy so much of when times are bad.
You would like to be in areas that are what we call non-discretionary, things that you have to buy. For example, healthcare, education, or consumer staples, toothpaste and toilet paper.
And what about that old tradition of stuffing cash in your mattress?
Right now, the value of the dollar is falling. Maybe you want to have some yuan in the mattress or some rupees in the mattress right now.
Experts say the time to make portfolio adjustments is now, before stocks turn south.
if you wait for everybody and their brother to say that there's a recession, it's probably too late, and then you're better off just buying and holding.
By buying and holding, he means doing nothing to your portfolio. The problem is that it's hard to get the timing right. Mark Weidemer is an economics professor at Claremont McKenna College. He's studied how financial markets have reacted to economic downturns over the past two centuries.
You can't pinpoint exactly the timing of when the market's going to fall and when the market's going to recover. I mean, otherwise, if you could, then investors could change their portfolios appropriately and make a lot of money.
Weidemeyer recommends keeping a diverse portfolio, stocks, bonds, real estate, cash, in good times and bad, and be willing to ride the roller coaster. Indeed, you could take a lesson from CalPERS, the nation's largest pension fund. It's not making any recessionary adjustments. It's keeping 64% in stocks, half of which are in a passive index fund. In New York, I'm Jill Varshay for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
it's like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what is the straight story. All right, Chris, we just heard how to get ready for a downturn. Now, here's my challenge. Where is the economy headed? You have top-flight Wall Street analysts proclaiming a recession is coming, a recession is coming. Henny penny. Yet, you know, other folks will strongly disagree. So the question for you, recession or no?
Honestly, Tess, I don't have a clue.
Oh, geez.
No, I try. I mean, look, the economy is unusually confusing and for people like me, fascinating right now. So I'd ask myself one question, and it's the question that really matters. Will the debt crisis submerge the economy or not? And what's your best guess?
I don't have one.
All right, here's a straight story. No one can predict the future. But if you calmly monitor the economy's temperature, you can steer clear of the Scylla of doom and the Charybdis of overconfidence.
Well, I'm going to cut to the chase here. I said I didn't have a guess. Do you?
Yes, I do have a guess.
Okay.
And I'm actually with the consensus. Ben Bernanke, Federal Reserve Board Chairman, basically what he's saying is, look, the economy's going to grow at 2%. So that's what we call a growth recession. Recession's bad. That's negative. But at 2%, you don't generate a whole lot of jobs either. That's my best guess.
All right. Well, there are so many indicators out there that we're supposed to watch for. What would you suggest that we look out for?
Because the crisis is concentrated in the housing market, that's what I would really look for. And don't worry about prices falling. What you want to concentrate on is sales. Mm. Because as sales occur, that means more people are going to be optimistic. Yes, some people are going to be disappointed, the ones who are selling. But you're clearing out this mess that we call the housing market. So monitor sales very closely.
But I think that's interesting because there's a bit of a vicious circle there, which is that a lot of home buyers, I think, are waiting to see whether the housing market has bottomed out.
Well, I think that's why you monitor, because it's part of that conversation, because it's not going to happen where a bell is going to go off. What it is conversations. You'll have some people over at your house and they'll be talking about a friend of theirs that went and got a house and they got a really good deal. Mm-hmm. And whether or not you actually hit bottom at that point, it does mean that the worst is over with the market.
All right. So we've got housing, but we always hear about, well, you got to watch the GDP numbers and consumer spending. Well, consumer spending keeps going up, even though the economy seems not to be doing quite as well as people would hope. How do you sort through all those different factors?
Well, you can drive yourself crazy. But in the particular environment we're in right now, I'd monitor what's happening on the holiday sales front. I don't know if you've gotten these emails and you've read some of the stories about online retailers are cutting deals.
Yep.
If they're getting sales and if it works, then that's a good sign that the consumer has a certain amount of confidence about their overall financial situation. But if we got these deals out there, no one's taking advantage of this. That's a really nerve-wracking sign. I'd be nervous. The other thing that I'd monitor is something that I know drives you absolutely crazy, but I am going to say it. You got to watch the stock market. The stock market is a very sensitive indicator to what's happening to corporate profits, what's the outlook for business. So any one day, any week, you can't take the stock market too seriously, but I still would pay attention to it.
Yeah, and this week certainly seems to be a perfect example of that. I mean, we had a bunch of down days, and then all of a sudden it just popped right back up again.
Hey, you know, and Bear Stearns wrote off a bunch of debt, and that's good news. And in fact, that's one other thing. Richard Fisher, he's head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
So in his speech this week, he said, watch for those cow patties.
Cow patties?
Cow patties. The earnings write-down that's coming from banks and investment banks.
The bad news, in other words.
The bad news. I actually think the more that they acknowledge what's wrong, that's actually an optimistic sign because they're going to be clearing out a lot of this bad stuff, and then the economy can go ahead and start growing. So watch those cow patties closely.
All right, cow patties, you heard it here first, folks. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Des.
So we may not know the future at this point and what it holds in terms of recession, but we can look back at the past and see one of the major factors that led to these fears, the housing bubble. Ah, remember those heady days? Well, now we call it the subprime mortgage crisis. And while there's plenty of blame to go around, mortgage brokers have been getting a big portion of it. Elizabeth Warren is a professor of law at Harvard University, and she recently penned an editorial in the Boston Globe critical of mortgage brokers. Elizabeth, first of all, what's the broker's job?
Mortgage brokers advertise themselves as one-stop shopping, and the mortgage broker will compare dozens of lenders and give you, the customer, the best deal.
Sounds like the way to go.
Well, what the mortgage broker sometimes fails to disclose, however, the broker gets a fee. And the first part of the fee is for filling out the paperwork and helping the customer find his way or her way to the mortgage company. But there's a second part that is sometimes added to the fee, and that's an additional part called a yield spread premium, which is paid by the mortgage company back to the broker if the broker sells the customer on a more expensive version of the mortgage.
You have gone so far as to call this a bribe.
Well, I don't know what else to call it. There are a lot who are inside the mortgage industry who understand that mortgage brokers may sometimes be terrific people who help customers, but they may also be acting on their own behalf. And the big trick in the marketplace is you can't tell which one you've got.
But doesn't that show up in your final documents when you go to sign your papers for the house?
Oh, sure. It's somewhere in that 3 inches of documentation. But the part that is never disclosed is it's disclosed as a fee, but nobody ever explains what the fee was for.
Is there a way for you to know if this is happening to you?
It's almost impossible to sort out in advance what the mortgage broker is doing. Part of the real difficulty is in the structure of how the mortgage market works right now. It's expensive to nail down your mortgage quote. And the reality is, in order to guarantee you're getting the lowest price, you've got to go to multiple mortgage brokers, multiple banks. And to do that, it costs a lot of money.
Well, brokers would likely argue that they should get paid and that that's what the yield spread is there for, to pay them.
Brokers should absolutely be paid for acting on your behalf. What they should not be able to do is to get paid by the mortgage company for selling you a more expensive mortgage than the one you qualified for.
Elizabeth Warren teaches law at Harvard and is the author of The Two Income Trap. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me here.
Want to be the next Warren Buffett? Chris clues us in on value investing and remembering the dark days of American cooking.
Used to be basil and oregano was probably the most different seasoning that you'd see.
We spend a day in the work life with a recipe developer. That's ahead on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. So you may have heard, Thanksgiving's this Thursday. No, seriously. If you're in charge of preparing the holiday dinner, here's the good news. No one expects you to get creative. Cook up a bird or a vegetarian substitute, stuffing of some kind, cranberry something or other, pie or two. Happy Thanksgiving. But on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we head to the kitchen with Del Monte's resident nutritionist. There, she turns standard canned food into not-so-standard recipes.
And right now I have a little bit of olive oil heating up in our nonstick skillet, just about a tablespoon. I'm going to put the chicken breasts in and really get them nice and browned. My name's Laura Molseed. I'm a registered dietitian. I work for Del Monte Foods. I'm the nutritionist. Now I'm going to add the pear liquid that I've drained from the pears. We're going to end up with a nice gingered pear sauce to put over the chicken along with the pears. I spent about 15 years working in a hospital and working with patients and clients, teaching them about nutrition. And I did a little bit of recipe development with them just to show them how easy it is to make things. From there, I worked for Giant Eagle, our local supermarket chain, for a brief period of time, and then came to Del Monte. Well, honestly, one of the first things I do is monitor trends. I look at various cooking magazines, read websites, to try and get an idea of what consumers are looking for, what types of products they're using, what flavors are kind of the new and up and coming, and work with our products to develop things that our consumers would really be interested in. I work with every product we produce, from green beans to asparagus spears. Sometimes I will have a new product presented to me and kind of, what can you do with this? You know, I'll sit and I'll think about it and I'll look through some different things to spark an idea. I have a committee that comes down and tastes them, and then I have a committee of friends at home that are willing to try things. I usually have more people show up than have been actually invited. We shoot for under 10 ingredients per recipe. You know, people don't want to be spending all day pulling ingredients out of their shelves or having to go to the supermarket to get things that they don't normally have. And try and keep the cooking time, prep time, to no more than 30 minutes. Everybody's time-starved now. We need it to be quick and easy. The salary for this type of position can really range. $35,000 up to $50,000 for somebody who's in a very entry-level, fresh-out-of-school position. And if you've got a fair amount of experience, $55,000 up to $85,000 or higher. You know, I think we've been bringing in a lot of different food cultures to the American people, and I think people are becoming a lot more adventurous and more willing to try new things and new flavors. When before it used to be basil and oregano was probably the most different seasoning that you'd see, now people really are looking for new things and keeping things like this, like ground ginger or teriyaki-flavored tuna on their shelf to use. I can do so many more things than probably you could have done 40, 50 years ago.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Mark Newtbar. We've got links to some Laura-approved recipes on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
Cloudy skies bring us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, quarterly forecast. A quarterly forecast isn't a seasonal weather report, but rather a thunderous new move by the Federal Reserve. It refers to the number of times the public will hear how the economy is doing. For almost 30 years, the Fed published its economic report twice a year. But this week, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke said he'd increase the number of headaches on Wall Street by publishing the report four times a year. Many say it's Big Ben's attempt to leave a stamp on the Fed, but these days it could give him a new nickname, Bad News Bernanke.
Got a box full of letters.
Hello again, loyal listeners, and this is that time in the show where we take on your financial problems and questions and try to provide some good, solid answers. Right, Chris?
Absolutely. And this is the part where we get to really talk to people. It's fun.
That's right. And of course, that is our own financial editor and knower of all things, Chris Farrell. But before we start, take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Or if you like, you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right, Lynn is on the line from Westchester, California. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you?
We are doing well, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm a special ed teacher. I've got two daughters, and one of them is up at the University of Washington, and we have a little question about her finances.
Oh, terrific. What's your question?
Well, she has managed to work hard during the summers, and she's actually saved quite a bit of money, and she's wondering if she should take some of that money right now and pay off the existing loans. She's currently a junior, and so we're wondering if that would be the best use of her money at this time.
What's she studying?
Her major is the comparative history of ideas.
So she'd be expecting to make a lot of money when she graduates, right?
Yeah, that's part of the problem. And I think that she thinks that it would be a lot of worry off her head if she was able to get some of these loans underway.
How much does she have in loans?
Currently, she has about $13,000 in loans.
And what does she have saved?
About $14,000.
Wow. Well, Chris, would this be a wise use of that money that she's saved over the last few years?
Well, normally I give the advice, you know, pay off the loans. Why do you want the interest to compound? But in this case, she's a junior, and I would lean toward not paying off the loans at this point. She has the savings. I'd keep the savings. And the reason why I wouldn't pay it off right now is she's going to graduate. And then I don't know what she's going to do, but obviously she's a hard worker. And having that savings is going to give her some financial flexibility while she explores what it is she wants to do, where she's going to be living. She gets a 6-month grace period after she graduates before she has to start paying down those loans. Plus, there's no prepayment penalty with student loans whatsoever. So if she pays it off early, doesn't matter. If she pays it off over a year or two, because obviously she has the savings, or 3 years, it doesn't really matter. So she's actually in an ideal position to, you know, pursue what it is she wants to do with that degree and when she graduates. And I'd be really reluctant for her to give up that financial freedom and that financial flexibility, since there's really not much of a financial penalty to her to wait.
Okay, great. Well, that sounds like wonderful advice, and really not what we had come up with in our family. We weren't necessarily going directly to the concept of, you know, pay it all off, but we thought, well, maybe some of it. So it's nice to be able to hear that we shouldn't kind of let the idea of getting the monkey off her back kind of rule where she would be best suited.
And Chris, we should certainly congratulate Lynn's daughter on being a saver so early in life. That bodes well for years to come.
Yes, that part's great. We're very proud of her. She's a hard worker.
No, you should be. You know, at a minimum, we're talking a year and a half. I mean, if she wants to get rid of it in a year and a half, it's gone.
Exactly.
All right. Well, best of luck to you and your daughter.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for the call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, let's reach into the email bag. And Mike writes in from Minneapolis, Minnesota, your neck of the woods, once again. We have a lot of listeners from your neck of the woods, Chris.
Yes, we do. We take our personal finances seriously out here.
All right, well, Mike certainly does. He recently joined an investment club, and they are always on the lookout for undervalued stocks to invest in. That's a mark of a good investor. He's used to looking at broad-based index funds. Yay, Mike. For his 401k and IRA. But this is a different type of investment, of course. What are the resources that he can use that are going to point him toward undervalued companies to invest in through this club? But then also his question, is there a danger in flirting with those undervalued stocks in the first place?
Well, just very quickly, value investing means you want to be like Warren Buffett. You're looking for stocks that are out of favor, that have been beaten down, and yet for some reason, you know, they're worth a lot more than the stock market, which is, you know, stock market has fads, and you get it on the cheap.
And you can't argue with a Warren Buffett style of investing.
No, you can't. And so that's the first thing that I would do is, you know, look at www. BerkshireHathaway.com. That's his company, Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway. Letter from the chairman in the annual report from Berkshire Hathaway. It's all online, and it is wonderful, wonderful lessons in value investing. And by the way, it's also very well written, and it's funny.
It is.
There's also a very good book that just recently came out. It's by Christopher Brown, called The Little Book of Value Investing. It's written for the novice. If you are an expert, this is not a book for you. But if you are someone who's heard about value investing, you want to understand the techniques of a value investor, pick up The Little Book of Value Investing.
Okay, so this is not going to point them toward actual companies that they should invest in, but this is going to give them some helpful hints on what to look for in those companies.
Exactly. And then that's the magic, the beauty of the online universe. Once you sort of know what you're looking for, you know, then there are so many places that you can go, from Morningstar, for example, being one. But there are plenty of other places, Standard & Poor's. I mean, there's just lots of places you can go to get the financial information, the management information that you need. But what's most important is getting that grounding and the education, the learning about what it really takes to be a value investor.
All right. And if you want some more information on starting an investment club or joining one, we've been doing a whole series about that all year. And you can go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on investment clubs. If you want, you can give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's Ask Money. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right. Caller number two is with us. And John is in Columbia, Maryland. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
What do you do there in Maryland?
I'm a engineer.
What kind of engineer?
I'm a computer engineer.
So what's your question for Chris today?
Well, back in March of this year, my then fiance and I bought a house together. We got the mortgage together. We had both of our names on it. It just so happens the way we filled out the paperwork, her name was first, simply because that's the way the paperwork went around the table. She was listed as borrower. I was listed as co-borrower.
Okay.
They took both of our incomes into account, and we got the mortgage. We got the house as well, and we are both listed on the title, and we're listed as joint tenants and not tenants in the entirety because we weren't married at the time we bought the house.
Okay. Sounds good.
Got the house. Everything's been fine. But fast forward to about a month ago, and my wife had to open up a new checking account, and she got turned down for the little bitty $500 of overdraft protection, which at this bank is a credit line.
Hmm.
And it turns out that on her credit report, they list our entire mortgage as being her debt.
And not a shared debt.
And not a shared debt. Now, I don't even know how that necessarily works. So that leads into the question of how do we fix it so that the credit reporting agencies take both my income and her income into account since it's a shared debt?
Hmm. Chris, is this as simple as changing what's on the title?
Yes. Have you gone back to the mortgage lender?
We went to the mortgage lender after this happened, and we've sent them a copy of our marriage certificate to say, hey, we're married, make sure you change the name on our accounts. But we haven't had a chance to do that with the title company yet.
So that's what you would do with the title company, and the problem should redress itself by doing so. And then if you want to be extra cautious, you can go ahead and there's a space online, or you can just send in a certified letter to the credit reporting bureau about the change in your circumstances so that they recognize it. But this should be cleared up fairly simply. But yes, I would contact the title company.
How long do you think it would take for it to filter through to all the credit agencies and all that?
You know, there's the technical answer, and then there's the real world answer. Technically, we really are talking no more 30 to 60 days. And actually, in the real world, I think that's also what you're talking about, but it could be a little longer than that.
All right. Does that help you out, John?
That's perfect. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Well, your FICO score is certainly the most important three-digit number you can have, but here's a 10-digit number that's pretty important, too. It's our phone number. 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or if you'd like, you can also visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, one more reach into the email bag, Chris. And Gerardo writes in from Naperville, Illinois, and he wants to hear your opinion on the traditional cap-weighted index funds versus fundamental indexing. Oh, my goodness, this guy should host the show. What is the better investment strategy for the long run? Let's start, first of all, with a definition, cap-weighted index funds.
All right. There is a war going on in this dull boring world of indexing. Let's do a little bit of definitions here. The capitalization weighted indexes, which the classic example is the Standard & Poor's 500, which we talk about a lot, okay? And what all capitalization weighted means is that the heft of each stock in the index is relative to the market value of its shares. So the critics of capitalization weighted indexes say when Microsoft is really hot, it becomes a bigger part of the index. Or, for example, to make it even easier, back in 1998, 1999, early 2000, remember how hot technology was?
Mm-hmm.
Technology became a bigger and bigger part of the S&P 500. So the fortunes of the S&P 500 became more and more dependent on what was happening in technology stocks. Before we had the housing market bubble, it was financial services stocks that were really driving the Standard & Poor's 500. So that's what capitalization weighted means. Now, there's a bunch of academics and quant jocks who have come together and said, this is not the way to do it. We want to be indifferent to whether or not a stock is hot or not. You want it to be less susceptible to market mood swings. And you want to come closer to ranking companies on their importance in today's economy. So, for example, one of these newfangled funds has Walmart and General Motors in the top 10 holdings. But neither Walmart nor General Motors, last time I looked, is in the top 10 holdings in the Standard & Poor's 500. So how do we divide this universe? How do we decide? We've gone through all these definitions. What do you want to do? Here's how I decide. The new fundamental indexes tend to be value-weighted. They tend to be value-oriented. So if you want to be the Warren Buffett of indexes, you might lean toward a fundamental, but you tend to pay higher fees. So guess what people like me say? Reason why I'm indexing is I really don't want to think about this very much. And secondly, I really don't want to pay high fees. So I lean toward the old-fashioned S&P 500 capitalization weighted. Bottom line, you are doing better by investing in either choice compared to the average mutual fund where you're paying a lot of money for a high-priced stock picker that's going to underperform both the capitalization weighted index and the fundamental weighted index. So, hey, as far as I'm concerned, put a dartboard up against the wall, take a dart, throw it. If I were throwing it, it'd end up with the S&P 500. If he throws it and it's fundamental, he didn't make a bad decision.
Dartboard investing. That's what
it's
we're all
dartboard
about.
Dartboard investing. That's what we, exactly. That is what we are about.
All right. Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions, all the darts that we can throw this week. But do leave your questions for a future program on our voicemail. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or visit our contact page on our website. It's marketplace.org. Chris, thanks as always for your perfect aim.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Coming up, the ins and outs of health savings accounts. Is this new benefit option the right fit for you? And as we prepare to head to the mall for holiday shopping, one activist calls for divine intervention to slow down our consumer culture.
We want to save Christmas from the shopocalypse. Somehow, gift-giving became purchasing.
Meet the Reverend Billy and his Stop Shopping Gospel Choir. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Are you stressed and confused? Could be all that traveling you're doing for the holidays. Or maybe it's because it's open enrollment season. Time to pick your health plan at work. And you're probably hearing about something called an HSA, a health savings account. But what exactly is it? Who is it best for? Well, we decided to get some answers from Paul Fronston of the Employee Benefit Research Institute. And Paul, what is the difference between an HSA and a regular health plan?
A health savings account is combined with that kind of insurance. The difference is, in order to make a contribution to a health savings account on a pre-tax basis, you must have a certain kind of health plan. A health plan with a deductible of at least $1,100 for an individual and $2,200 for a family. For some people, that's really high. There are many people out there right now with deductibles of $500. You have to look at it relative to where you are.
What's the difference between a health savings account and what are called the flex accounts, the flexible spending accounts that have also come into the lexicon of healthcare?
Flexible spending accounts have been around for the better part of 25 years, actually a little bit more than that. Those are accounts that you could, again, you, just like an HSA, you could use those accounts to pay for your healthcare expenses on a pre-tax basis. Your employer can contribute to them, but typically employers don't. And the amount of money you put into the account must be used during a certain period of time. And what you don't use, you lose. The HSA, the health savings account, it's something that where you don't lose the money. Employers often do contribute to the account in addition to your contributions. And what's left over at the end of the year stays in the account for you to use in the future.
So when you say the company often will contribute to that, is that similar to, say, a 401k match then?
It's similar, but not exact. Typically, employers will contribute the same amount to the account, whether or not you make a contribution yourself.
So they're putting money in even if you don't?
That's right. They may, for example, put in a flat $500 per employee. And if you want to add to that, you're free to do so.
What's the benefit of an HSA to a company?
The idea behind the HSA isn't so much about the HSA as much as it's about increasing the deductible to reduce premiums. The idea is to put more control over the dollars in people's hands so that they're making better decisions about their health care and hopefully using less health care. We have a crisis when it comes to health care costs, and employers are very concerned about how to manage those costs. So they're looking at different models, and this is just one of those models.
How does the HSA bring down the cost? Is it simply bringing down the cost for the company and shifting it to the employee?
It's bringing down the cost in two ways. One, just by going to a higher deductible, premiums come down. But what oftentimes happens is employers will take the savings from the lower premium and put it in the account. So the employer may not be saving money right off the bat. The hope is that if people use the healthcare system differently because they have an incentive to save money, that money is theirs. And as people are taking more responsibility over the expenses that you incur prior to reaching your deductible, the idea is that people will make better decisions and presumably use less healthcare.
Where does that assumption come from that we are actively not worrying about the cost of our health care? I mean, when I go to the doctor, I don't think about, well, you know, is this going to be expensive or not? I go because I got to go.
Well, that's where the assumption comes from. We know that because you're not concerned about the costs, a $20 copayment doesn't stop you from going to the doctor. There are times where people use healthcare services unnecessarily. It may not be, you know, should I go to the doctor or get this operation? It may be, is this operation preferable to taking a prescription drug?
But isn't that something where you're relying on your doctor to tell you what you should be doing? I mean, I'm not going to make the decision whether I should have surgery or get a prescription medicine. That's up to my doctor, isn't it?
Well, I think it's really has to be a combination of both of you. You need to understand what the benefits and the costs are in both cases. The issue right now is we're not giving people enough information to make informed decisions.
Who benefits most from an HSA? Who is that a good option for?
Well, there's no question it's good for people who are healthy. If you don't use healthcare, you're going to save money in the account, and that money will be there when something unexpected happens. Remember, there's a part of insurance that's for unexpected events. The people who are going to have the toughest time are low-income people whose employers don't contribute to the account because they're going to have a higher deductible than they're used to, and they're not going to have the means to save money in the account to pay for their healthcare expenses. They may go without healthcare as a result.
What if, for example, you have a chronic condition like diabetes?
I could argue it both ways. I could argue that somebody with diabetes may, in fact, be better off under one of these plans. They may have seen their premium go down enough to fund the account to the point where their out-of-pocket expenses haven't increased. So they may, in fact, be better off, but they may be worse off. They may not be getting, from a cost perspective, the savings from the premium. It may not be recycled into their account. It all depends upon where they're starting from.
Paul Fronston is Director of Health Research Programs for the Employee Benefit Research Institute. Thanks for helping us out.
Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
All this week, we've been talking about America's consumer culture and whether it's sustainable. It's a series called Consumed. Well, just in time for the holiday shopping season, there's a new film from director Morgan Spurlock of Super Size Me fame. It's called What Would Jesus Buy? a look at the life of an activist named Reverend Billy. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has the story.
Stop! Give us some beef!
Shopping!
Stop! Shopping! Stop!
At a recent revival in New York City, the Reverend Billy and his choir preached the gospel they've been traveling around the country to spread. They drop into malls and big box stores, dressed in their red flowing gowns as if they've just come off the pulpit, singing to the people who flocked to buy, buy, buy.
Reverend Billy, what is the mission? What is it you're trying to tell people?
We're trying to get them to slow down that consumption, amen. We're addicted, and we're conflicted, we're hypnotized, consumerized.
Sometimes Reverend Billy goes door to door.
Oh, look at this.
Can we sing you a song?
Absolutely.
One, two, three.
All right. Joy to the world in the form of goods. Consume, consume, consume. Like plastic this and that. We're screaming little brats. Take the SUV to the mall. Take the SUV to the mall.
As you might imagine, the holiday season is a big one for Reverend Billy to get his message across, thus the timing of the movie release.
We want to save Christmas from the shapocalypse.
The shift to the commodification of Christmas, that you have to actually purchase your gift, that shift, which took place slowly over time in American history, somehow gift-giving became purchasing.
When Reverend Billy came into the Marketplace studios this week with his wife, Savitri, I confessed I am a convert. 10 years ago, frustrated by the mania to spend money on stuff just for the sake of spending money, I quit buying gratuitous Christmas presents for my family. Some people find that a bit strange, but not Reverend Billy.
Sister Lisa, do you do something in the place of not shopping for Christmas? What else do you do?
I go see them. Exactly. You
That's
are
it. That's the perfect gift.
You are the gift.
Your time, your love.
Time, love, and an expensive plane ticket. As the opening of Reverend Billy's new movie reminds us, not everyone else out there shares this particular holiday philosophy.
Three quarters of us view Christmas with more dread than anticipation. Yet we'll spend $500 billion on Christmas this year and create 5 million tons of extra waste.
Of course, consumerism isn't just confined to the back end of the year. Reverend Billy knows there's always a need for his gospel, like this scene from the movie where a woman came to him to confess that she goes into the same clothing store every single day to shop. She fell in love with a dress that didn't fit and got into trouble.
I wanted this dress so bad, and I pulled it up and I got it on. Well, I could not get it off, and I had a little key scissors on my keychain, and I cut myself out of it because I didn't want to embarrass myself and not be able to go back to that store. But I probably shouldn't have done that.
Sister, the fabulous creator that gave you your wonderful body is saying something to you at that moment. Your body destroyed that dress, and it did the right thing.
Back at that revival in New York, Reverend Billy asks would-be followers to reconsider their credit cards.
Reach down into your purses, please. Reach down into your wallets. Get out the plastic now, and we will help you. And we'll preempt that shopping.
Of course, Reverend Billy doesn't expect that everyone's going to stop shopping cold. But this holiday season, he's asking you to think about what you're buying, where you're buying it from, and why you're buying it.
It's for the kids. It's for the kids. I don't care if I go broke. It's for my kids.
You don't have to attend services at the Church of Stop Shopping to know that you shouldn't equate love with spending.
Hallelujah.
In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace Money.
And we wanted to share one correction to our consumed special from last week. I said 42 tons of trash crossed state lines for disposal in 2005. Well, that wouldn't be very impressive. The right number, 42 million tons, is impressive. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Most people need a little more than the power of prayer to get home for the holidays. It's getting a tad late, though, to buy inexpensive airfare. Scott McCartney writes the middle seat column for the Wall Street Journal, and he's here with some advice for you procrastinators who haven't booked your seats yet. Scott, should they at this point just hope for a miracle?
You know, this was a very interesting holiday season. People booked quite early, started booking earlier than probably ever before. And I think there's a growing realization that prices just are going to keep going up as you get closer to the holiday period. What you can do now is really play around with the dates that you travel. Midweek, you really have more flexibility in terms of, you know, when you're actually going to travel. There are still going to be some good prices for the off-peak days at the holidays.
What kind of improvements, if any, have we seen since the absolute disasters of this summer where people were stuck on runways and all the flight delays? It was one awful summer for anyone who wanted to fly.
You know, it really was. I'm concerned about this holiday period. There are lots of problems in the system. A few airlines have talked about creating more slack in the system, holding back some seats on flights in busy markets at the holiday period so that you do have a little bit more ability to rebook people if flights get canceled. It's really a situation where I think there are going to be a lot of delays if the weather's bad and some people are going to get stranded.
What are some strategies for folks who do find themselves stranded or having to deal with the airlines on rebooking at the last minute and that sort of thing? Because, as you said, you never know when a storm's going to come up.
You know, going to the airport is now a little bit like going on a camping trip. I think there are a few really important strategies. One is pay attention to the weather. If there's a storm bearing down on Chicago and your connection is through Chicago, call the airline and see if you can, you know, switch, get rerouted so that you connect through, you know, Cleveland or Houston or wherever.
But then, of course, they're going to charge you the change fee. And, you know, if the ticket is more expensive to go through Houston or Denver, they're going to charge you more money.
Well, often they waive those in a storm situation. So if they're anticipating trouble, they will waive the change fees and things like that. The bigger issue is whether they have empty seats somewhere that they can rebook you. But the sooner you call, the better your chance is to get the last couple seats or things like that before everybody else starts calling. You know, you really have to sort of take matters into your own hands.
There was some talk over the summer, during the summer troubles, of legislation or policies to force the airlines to somehow compensate passengers who get stuck on a plane for 10 hours or who get bumped. What happened with that?
Two different things. The compensation for bumping is a regulatory matter at the Department of Transportation. It's been more than 20 years since those compensation amounts have been increased. And so I think we'll see some kind of increase in the penalties for that. And that's a good thing. If the airline can take another passenger for a $1,500 ticket and pay you $400 for bumping you, I really think that's wrong. That's a financial incentive for the airline to bump people, and that's not a good thing.
Right.
In terms of the passenger bill of rights and all that, it's really tricky because, you know, not all flights are the same, and some flights don't want to have to cancel after 4 hours. It's very hard to make hard and fast rules. If you're the 9 a.m. Flight from New York to Chicago just full of business people, you know, they may be willing to wait longer than the 9 p.m. flight to Orlando with a bunch of kids on the flight where, you know, a 6-hour wait is just not acceptable. It's hard, especially with the low fare environment and the financial trouble that airlines have had. It's in some ways, you know, hard to impose severe penalties on them when often it's not the airline's fault. It's the FAA's fault or the airport has a problem or, you know, the system just is not able to accommodate all the traffic.
Scott McCartney is the author of the Middle Seat column in The Wall Street Journal. Scott, I hope you really don't have to have the middle seat every time you fly.
It does happen. Happened just last week, as a matter of fact.
Thanks for your time.
Sure. Good to be with you.
And finally, let's leap from the fun of holiday travel to the horror of debt, more specifically debt collectors. The Federal Trade Commission has reached a settlement with a collection company in Texas called LTD Financial Services. The agency said LTD illegally harassed debtors. The company forked over almost $1.5 million in the deal. So we called up Lauren Saunders. She's an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center. And we asked her, when it comes to debt collection, what exactly is illegal harassment?
Abusive telephone calls, threats, use of obscene or profane language, calling friends, neighbors, employers, or threatening to do so. It's also illegal to threaten somebody, to throw them in jail, to claim that they've committed a crime and they'll be reported.
What collectors can do is call, offer you repayment options, and explain what you owe and why. They can also take you to court, which leads to question number two, why bother with harassment?
Well, first of all, it's a lot cheaper to call you up or put you on an auto dialer than it is to actually hire a lawyer and go to court. Also, many debt collectors don't have sufficient proof to go to court and actually get a judgment.
Of course, you probably can't afford to drag a collector to court either. So what do you do if you're a victim of harassment?
You should definitely complain to the Federal Trade Commission, which is right now accepting public comments on debt collection abuses. They're still collecting comments even though the November 9th deadline has passed. You can also complain to a state agency that regulates debt collectors.
And we've got some links to help you file those complaints. They're on our website, marketplace.org. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, a special travel-themed show. We experience the joys and pain of vacationing in a foreign country.
Is this the emergency room?
Yeah.
You speak English?
Yes, I speak English.
I ran into a metal pole, chest first.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Special thanks this week to our engineers Johnny Vince Evans and Eamon Coyne here in St. Paul. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. Enjoy the Thanksgiving holiday, and we'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.